You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Abu Sfyan Abdelrazik is a Canadian citizen from Montreal. In 2003, he went back to the Sudan to visit his sick mother. When he was there, he was thrown into jail and tortured on suspicion of ties to Osama bin Laden. In March, the Globe and Mail newspaper made public documents indicating that the Canadian Security Intelligence Service had asked the Sudanese authorities to detain Mr. Abdelrazik. The Sudanese government released him after 19 months, saying that they could no longer detain an innocent man at the behest of a foreign government. He's now in the Canadian Embassy in Khartoum, where he has been living for the past 11 months. The Canadian government took his old passport and refuses to issue him a new one. Yavar Hamid is Mr. Abdelrazik's lawyer, and he joins me by phone from Ottawa. Hello, Yavar.
Hi, good afternoon.
Now, yesterday the case was in the headlines again. What happened?
Well, yesterday Mr. Abdelrazik was supposed to come back. A number of his supporters, about 200 Canadians, had banded together and at personal risk to themselves, and I can tell you about that later, they purchased a ticket for him. And the only real impediment for him to actually coming back to Canada was for a consular official to issue him an emergency passport, an emergency travel document. So he was waiting for that. We've been waiting for that for about 2 weeks. And then just a couple of hours before his flight was to depart, we received a letter from counsel to the minister, Lawrence Cannon, indicating that the request of Mr. Abdelrazik was refused on the ground that effectively that he was considered to be a national security threat to Canada. And then that same line was echoed by Mr. Cannon himself in Europe, where he was contacted for comment. So there's no ambiguity about it. The Canadian government for 11 months has had someone in the embassy who it considers to be a national security threat. It makes no sense.
Now, let's talk about the conditions that were set. There was a condition originally that he would need to have an airline to carry him back to Canada and that he would need a ticket. How did you meet those two conditions?
Well, the question of an airline was basically a number of airlines were contacted, and Etihad Airlines was one where it has been, it is willing, and we believe it may still hope to carry Mr. Abdelrazik in the future. Every airline, as I understand it, has its own policy of no fly, and so certain airlines are more independent than others, and Etihad seems to be one that, knowing all the facts of the case, is willing to transport him. So that's something that's really just dealt with on an airline by airline basis. As far as the purchase of the ticket to bring him back, it's an interesting situation because in view of the fact that Mr. Abdelrazik is a listed person on a UN terror list, Canada has created its own domestic regulations saying that for any listed person, it's a federal offense to fund them. It's a federal offense to collect money on their behalf. And so with that knowledge, that you know, collecting money, buying or purchasing a ticket is against the law. 200 Canadians stood up and said, "Well, you know what? We'll still do it. We think that this is an injustice, and we're ready to purchase this ticket." They did it. Not only did they do it, but their names have all been posted publicly. The amounts that they've donated as well. And essentially, the government now has a choice whether it's going to prosecute these individuals. And to date, the government has remained silent on that issue, which is an interesting comment, because I think that by acting by this measure of direct action, the Canadian public has really called the government out on the real absurdity of some of its policies, and now effectively, I think what they did is they cornered this government into making a really absurd decision that if it weren't for this sort of bold move on the part of the Canadian public, the Canadian government could have rested behind this fallacious justification of Mr. Abdelrazzak being on the UN terror list as the basis for his denial of passage back to Canada.
And I understand that the RCMP and CSIS have said that they have nothing on him. They have cleared him.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there is kind of this discourse, and it's a false one, that the government of Canada has been perpetuating, saying, you know, Mr. Abdelrazzak needs to come off the UN terror list, and that's up to him to do so. The process of trying to get him off the UN terror list was initiated back in the fall of 2007, and the Canadian government, in the process of apparently moving to delist Mr. Abdelrazzak, did its own investigation. They said, you know, before we're actually going to support a measure of delisting, we'll actually investigate Mr. Abdelrazzak. They did this. Both the RCMP and CSIS said, you know, we have nothing on our files that says that that he is or has been engaged in any criminal activity. That, coupled with the fact that Mr. Abdelrazzak has never been charged with a criminal offense anywhere in the world, he has no criminal record, shows that he is completely clean as far as any charge, any indictment, or, you know, any suspicion that should devolve from that. And you know, despite that, you know, he wasn't capable of becoming delisted. And you know, as of a week ago, Mr. Cannon's position was that it's up to Mr. Abdelrazzak to get himself delisted. Now, if a person who is completely free of criminal charge or formal accusation cannot get him off the list, it's virtually impossible for him to get off that list.
I understand that the Canadian government sent the UN some information a while back. Do we know what's in that information that they sent the UN about Mr. Abdelrazzak?
No, I mean, that's a very good point, because you know, the you know, this justification is being raised that, you know, he's to get himself off, and somehow that process of delisting should be an accessible one. But you know, quite the contrary is true, because despite the fact that there was a delisting request back in the fall of 2007, we have never been able to see the exact documents or communications between Canada and the United Nations. And Canada's position is that, well, this is confidential, and it has to remain confidential. And I can't really understand the logic of that, because, indeed, if Canada was acting in good faith, if it was putting forward something which was truly in favor of Mr. Abdelrazzak, there would be no reason why that couldn't be shared with his solicitors or with Mr. Abdelrazzak himself. I suspect that there was something else in that recommendation that may have given the United Nations Sanctions Committee something to ponder upon.
Is it a real impediment that he's on the terror list? Could the Canadian government allow him in? Could they decide to do that?
Yeah, this terror list, just to get into a bit more into detail on that, it is pursuant to a special sanctions committee created by the United Nations in 1999, initially for the Taliban. Subsequent to that, in 2001 or 2002, Al-Qaeda got added to that ambit, and thereafter, a special resolution was created, 1390, which says that UN member states are not to permit the passage of people who are essentially Al-Qaeda operatives or Al-Qaeda agents. However, in the same section, which is Section 2B of Resolution 1390, which prohibits travel of individuals, it also says that there is an exception, a clear exception, where the country of nationality or country of citizenship attempts to repatriate that individual, that is permitted, that is permissible under the resolution. So there is formally no international bar to his repatriation.
So what do you think is behind the Canadian government's refusal then to allow him back in and the constant moving of the goalposts?
Well, I think that this is really a continuation of this insidious war on terror, which as we know is manifest in different ways in terms of military presence in other countries, whether it's in Afghanistan or Iraq, but it's also part of a political agenda to target suspected individuals, and I think also to protect the perception of the security intelligence and the measures that have been taken by international security personnel in terms of fingering people who may be involved in this war on terror. And so in this case, I think that Mr. Abdelrazzak is identified by the U.S. Department of State as a person of interest, someone potentially associated with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, despite the fact that there is no evidence, there's no basis for these allegations that we have ever seen or that Canada can even come up with. I think that there's this sort of reputational desire to protect the image that the war on terror, the importance of fighting it and casting certain individuals under this web of suspicion is very important. And we know the adverse impacts that this war on terror has had. We are very familiar with the case of Maher Arar and what happened to him. Similarly with Mr. Abdul al-Malki and Mr. al-Mati and Mr. Nuruddin. These are cases which are happening sort of more than we know. It just so happens that in this case, in the case of Mr. Abdelrazzak, the Canadian government has gone, in a sense, almost farther than it has in other cases. That is to say that it actually recommended Mr. Abdelrazzak's detention, visited him in detention, and is now actively frustrating his passage back to Canada. So this is a case, I think, which is the closest to what we would call extraordinary rendition of any of the sort of infamous cases that we know about.
And we're talking here about a Canadian citizen who is completely innocent of any suspicion.
Yes, I mean, innocent of suspicion. I mean, he's suspected. For whatever reason, but I guess the only way that we can really delve into, that we can really evaluate some kind of accusation, is where it's formalized, where there's some basis for that accusation, where there's some judiciable process where one can really assess what's going on. And this is certainly not the case. I mean, this suspicion is just, it's out there. It's like a stated allegation. I mean, to give you a sense of where this might have come from. I mean, we know from some of the documentaries and investigative journalism that's done into Guantanamo Bay, we have individuals who, under duress, under coercive interrogation, say all sorts of things. In fact, you've likely heard the indication that Omar Khadr identified Mr. Arar as being in Afghanistan at one point in time, and this is, we know this to be patently false. The evidence and Mr. Arar's whereabouts were very thoroughly probed in the Arar inquiry, and yet under duress, individuals can say whatever if they believe that the answer will satisfy their interrogators or their torturers.
Yaver Hamid is lawyer for Mr. Abusfian Abdelrazzak. He's a Canadian citizen currently living in the Canadian Embassy in Khartoum.